Hey.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Monday, March 16th, 2015, opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on General Government, and opening a public hearing on House Bill 5034 on the Public Employee Retirement System. Mr. Borden.
Good afternoon, co-chair and members of the subcommittee. Out on OLIS is some information that the agency has provided. That includes their governor's budget binder, their presentation for the next few days, and then a presentation notebook with appendices. And I would like to just say that the agency has done an outstanding job on that. That's a great resource for you to have and look over. It's very comprehensive, both on the system-wide view as well as the agency-specific view. A couple other things. Wednesday is a work session for two agency reports, and work session materials are out there for your review. And then lastly, the co-chair's budget makes no mention as to specifics to the agency's budget. So thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rodeman, Ms. Brickman, and anybody else who wants to come join you guys.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Roldman. I'm the Executive Director with the Public Employee Retirement System. Tamara, you want to introduce yourself?
Chair Steiner Harrod, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tamara Brickman with the Department of Administrative Services Chief Financial Office.
Thank you very much.
So we are scheduled to cover 3 days of materials with you. The first day is going to be focused on PERS, the system, which is basically the who, what, and where of the PERS benefits, note about system balance and the relative roles of the legislature, the PERS board, and the Oregon Investment Council, and a little discussion about employer contributions and future projections. On the second day, we're going to talk about the agency itself, our mission, vision, core values, and operating principles, our key goals, performance measures, and how our strategic plan development that we've engaged in over the next 5 years has driven our budget initiative for this biennium and into the future. And then on the third day, as Mr. Borden referenced, we have a couple of work session items on reports that we make through this subcommittee to the Ways and Means Committee, review also of the budget notes and the reports that were requested in the last biennium, and give you a progress report on those. And then lastly, our 2014 preliminary earnings crediting. So with that, talking about PERS as a system and an overview of PERS, we administer a tax-qualified government plan that provides retirement, death, and disability benefits for over 900 public employers. There is often discussion about PERS and state employees. State employees, as you'll see, comprise a minority percentage of the number of public employees who are in the PERS system. We serve state, university, city, county, local governments, special districts, so a broad variety of public employees. 95% of the public employees in the state have a connection into PERS. We're governed by a 5-member board of directors. That was the number set and the qualifications set in the 2003 PERS reforms. One of those board members is a represented public employee, member of a union, or a retired member. Another board member is either a state manager or a local government elected official. And then 3 members are appointed at large. They are experts in business management, pension management, or investing, but they are not allowed to have any connection to PERS. They cannot be beneficiaries or certainly members of PERS. So that 5-person board of directors governs the administration of the system and is charged with hiring me as the executive director and then providing, of course, the policy level decisions that run the system as we administer the plan as written by the legislature. We also have other components of PERS. The Oregon.
Mr. Rodeman, Senator Johnson.
Before you leave the composition of the board, would it be safe to say that one of the things some time ago that got PERS into trouble was having assigned seats on that board where people were negotiating from positions of interest rather than the fiduciary relationship with the system?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Johnson, when I first joined the system in 2001, we had an 11-person board of directors, and many of them were, as you say, representing specific constituencies. And I only got to spend a couple of years with that board. But I think your observation is correct in that having a narrow focus of who gets you onto that board kind of narrows the perspective you bring onto that. And I think we've been served well by having a 5-person board, and particularly 3 members at large who are just there to execute their fiduciary responsibility. They don't have any say or take in how things go with the system.
Follow. I appreciate your very candid answer, and I think the thing that we have to continue to guard against in this building is starting to assign seats of interest on boards and commissions again. It was my observation that that helped dig part of the hole at PERS that we're just recovering from, and that when we start assigning specific issue interests to seats, whether it's governance boards or whether they're advisory boards, you end up with these polarized, dysfunctional boards that get gridlocked in their positional posturing rather than remembering their services to the state of Oregon and the citizens of the state of Oregon and fiduciaries to the board or commission that they serve on. Thank you for your very straightforward answer.
Thank you. So, as I say, there's a couple of other components of PERS that are less talked about. One is the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. That is a deferred compensation plan that is available to state employees and other local government entities that choose to participate. So that is another arm through which state employees and those participating local government employees can have personal savings accounts within the contributions that they make can then grow throughout their career. Because one of the things we're going to hopefully make clear through this presentation is that, as we like to say, it's not your father's PERS anymore. Whereas people used to retire from state service in the 90s and early 2000s at or well above their final salary, that is happening less and less and is projected to decrease as we go into the future. Meaning one of our charges as a retirement administration system is making sure the public employees understand the consequence of that to themselves and that they know that they have to start building their three-legged stool in support of their retirement security. You will have PERS, but you will also have Social Security. But for a secure retirement, you're also going to need to build your own personal savings. And that's something that OSGP facilitates, and part of the education process we're starting to build in dealing with our members.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Would it be possible for you to provide the committee through the professional staff some indication of the level of participation? Again, there's enthusiasm in this building to try to encourage retirement savings, and I think all of us would say philosophically that's a good thing to build retirement savings. But whether or not the state gets into the retirement business above and beyond the Oregon Savings Growth Plan is the policy choice for the body. But if you could give us some indication, given that this is available to state employees and other participatory local government, what the rate of utilization for this opportunity is, that would be very helpful.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, that's actually one of our key performance measures that's already tracked by the legislature as far as state employee participation, and the target is 38%, and we've hovered around 35-36% over previous years. So that is only state employees. It doesn't take into account all of the other local governments that we serve, and it also doesn't take into account all the other savings vehicles that those local governments have available to them. School districts have different savings programs. So we'll try to get a more comprehensive picture of that for you instead of focusing, or we have the number for OSGP and state employees, but overall, like I say, in serving public employees, it'd be better to give you a larger picture of that.
Thank you so much.
So we also, PERS also administers a post-retirement health insurance program. And that program has 2 basic components. One is for public employees that have retired but before they are eligible for Medicare. And in that gap, we provide a pre-Medicare insurance program as a group insurance alternative for public employees. And there are restrictions on when and how a member can come into that program, and it's got generally pretty low participation. We'll cover that more when we get to the PERS health insurance report on day three. The main health insurance program that we administer is a Medicare supplemental program that covers a large number of public employees, and both of those programs are funded through the member premiums. So one of the unique features that we provide is we can take a portion of your retirement benefit and use that to pay your insurance premium. So it's easier for people to administer in that respect rather than having to cut a check or paying for it separately. The last thing that we do that I wanted to cover briefly is our Social Security compliance program. The state of Oregon has a general responsibility to assist with the federal Social Security program, and that responsibility is vested in PERS. So we have an individual who operates that program and administers that program, and that individual interfaces with an even wider variety of employers than PERS itself because it covers all the public employers in the state. So that's what we do at PERS. When you get to who is PERS, next slide, this is where we talk about the different components of the membership, and there's a couple of things to note here. As I say, the state is 54,000 of the total members, and active members, you see total around 200,000, and retired members about 128,000. So the state is just a relatively small piece of this pie, even when you include the university systems. Local governments and school districts have a large share of our membership roles. The other thing that this tells you about PERS is the relatively large number of retired members that we have in our system. We are what's called a mature retirement system in that a relatively larger percentage of our members are already in the benefit receiving side of their relationship with us. Other systems, even ones that are about the same age as PERS, haven't had as many people move into retirement as we did. And I think that goes back to that period in the 90s and 2000s when members were able to retire at a relatively early age with a relatively high benefit amount, which moved many of them into retirement rather than continuing on in their career. So we'll see a little later how this relative allocation between retired members and active and inactive members plays out in the financing dynamics of the system. A bit of an overview of the different terms and conditions of the PERS plan. We have three different plans depending on when an individual joined public employment. Tier 1 members are those who were hired before January 1 of 1996. Tier 2 members were hired between January of 96 and August of 2003. And then OPSERP members were hired after August of 2003. And OPSERP is the new system that was put in as part of PERS reform. And as you see in comparing the benefit levels, OPSERP is has a lower factor for retirement. In other words, for a 30-year career, a member will receive less of their final average salary in OPSERP than they would under Tier 1 and Tier 2, and also a higher retirement age. So whereas a Tier 1 member can retire with full retirement at 58, a Tier 2 member at age 60, an OPSERP at 65 before you can retire with full retirement benefits. Triggers for what we call police and fire or P&F members. Police and fire members have earlier retirement and higher factors because by the nature of those careers, they are shorter in duration than what we call general service public employees. So police and fire members will be able to vest in their retirement sooner or start their retirement sooner, I should say, and also have a higher statutory factor that's used to calculate their benefit. So let's talk about those benefit calculation methods for just a minute, because that's the row here that also varies among all of the different members. PERS has three different benefit calculation methods that we apply when a member goes to retire. So in a Tier 1 member retirement, When that person applies for retirement, I need to calculate their benefit in two or perhaps three ways. The two predominant ways are what's called money match and full formula, and I'll talk about what those are in just a second. And the third one is formula plus annuity. That's a more limited type of method that's used for members that have service all the way back to 1981. So if you were in the system before 1981, that calculation method is available to you. If not, then I'm just going to do the two methods when I calculate your benefit.
Representative Palm.
Thank you. I'm sure John can answer this, but I don't know what P and F are.
Police and fire.
Police and fire. Thank you.
Yeah.
So the calculation methods, the full formula is a standard calculation method for retirement systems like PERS that are defined benefit plan. We take your years of service. How long did you work for a public employer? What was your final average salary? And generally, in our case, that's your three highest years of salary. And a factor times that years of service. And the factor is 1.67 for a general service Tier 1 member. What that translates into is 30 years thought of as the general long-term career, 1.67 times 30 years is 50%. In a full career under PERS, you will get 50% of your final average salary. And that factor then is the same for Tier 2. So again, we're looking at 50% of your final average salary over 30 years. And then an OPSERP, it drops down to 1.5, so 45% of your final average salary.
Mr. Roman, can I just ask you a quick question to clarify? Am I right in remembering that there's also one exception to the final average salary, which is that if people had a time in their career where they had a much higher salary, that they can do it based on a look back? I mean, I think about, frankly, there are a bunch of legislators, for example, who come to the legislature after retiring from other public service careers who may not have opted into the retirement system yet, and when they were teaching or doing other things, had much higher salaries than we get in the legislature. And if your final 3 years are in the legislature, that, I mean, I think of Representative Plant, for example.
Yes, I'm giving up a lot to be here.
Yeah. Am I right about that, or am I misremembering?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, as with most things PERS, the answer is it's complicated.
Thank you for that honesty, as usual, Mr. Roman.
In tier one, your final average salary is your three highest years, or your last 36 months, and that's the same in tier two. But in OPSERP, it has to be three consecutive years, not just your three highest years.
Got it.
So it does vary depending on which program you're in.
But the answer is ultimately yes.
Ultimately yes, it's your three best years of earning.
Right.
So. If I may use Representative Kopp as an example, she is accruing service as a legislator during her time here. And when she goes to ultimately re-retire, we will include those additional years of service in calculating her benefit, and the three highest years will be applied to that factor to determine her benefit. So that's a standard retirement benefit calculation model, like I say, that we use across the three programs. Money match is different, and let me take a minute to explain what that is. Prior to 2003, members contributed 6% of their salary to an account with PERS, and it's called your regular account. And you had an option, maybe if you wanted to change the investment mix to have those contributions go into what's called a variable account, which was invested in equities instead of a broader portfolio. In any case, before 2003, your 6% went into that account. When you retired, one of the ways we would calculate your benefit is we would take your account balance and we would annuitize it. So when you retire, let's say at age 58, we have actuarial tables that tell us how long we think you're going to live, and we have an assumed earnings rate over the period of that retirement, and that calculates into a stream of benefits. So we would annuitize your account balance and pay you a monthly benefit for as long as you lived. Under money match, the match part of that is we would also take funds from your employer over your career and match your account balance. So you would have two streams of benefit payments, one funded by your account, the other funded by employer contributions that match your account balance. The money match calculation method is what drove the increase in retirement benefits in the 90s and 2000s, mm-hmm. because we had huge earnings years in the 80s and 90s where people who had money in their accounts, those earnings that were credited to those accounts grew exponentially. So by the time they went to retire in the mid to late 90s, their annuitized account balance matched by their employers well exceeded the factor-based full formula benefit. And that's how you got people retiring at 100 or 125% of their final average salary, because money match was driving that higher benefit amount.
Got it. Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Redmond. The assumed rate of the annuity is was the same as the assumed rate of the PERS investment portfolio. So the assumed rate of the annuity was 8%. I don't know of anywhere on earth you can buy an annuity with an 8% assumed rate other than PERS.
That's correct, Co-Chair Senator Whitsitt. That's correct in that is the rate that we use to annuitize the benefits. So the assumed rate used to be 8% for much of that period. We just dropped it to 7.75 last summer. It was 7.5 to 7.75 prior to that. So it's moved around a little bit, but you're correct in that we use the investment assumption rate to set that annuitization.
Thank you. Follow up, please. A couple other questions. On the lump sum vacation payout for the Tier 1 and Tier 2 and the unused sick leave, could you discuss how that was used by many retirees to significantly add to the total amount of their last year's compensation?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Senator Whitsitt, I talked generally about what final average salary was. It's your three highest years. There are a couple of exceptions or additions, as you've pointed out. If I get a lump sum vacation payout at retirement, and that is where my employer has decided to pay me for the vacation that I have accrued prior to the time that I leave their service, then that vacation payout is added in as salary to my calculation. So when I get a lump sum vacation payout, that can add to the annual salary. That's then one of the years that's used to calculate my three highest years. In addition, if you're in Tier 1 or Tier 2 and your employer chooses to participate in this program, then any unused sick leave that you have at the time that you leave service is you're credited with 50% of that unused sick leave to add into your final average salary. So you get half of your accrued sick leave added into your final average salary as well.
Thank you, Senator Steiner Hayward. Just to follow up on that question, so do you have numbers showing how many people, what percentage of people are taking advantage of that opportunity? I'm just curious as to, I mean, that could potentially be an expensive.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Taylor, we have figures in our CAFR. That's our comprehensive annual financial report that shows how much or talks about how much that adds to the cost of PERS. Mm-hmm. And generally, when you look at, I'm not going to even quote from memory because I'll get it wrong, but we'll look at it and we'll get back to you on that number. In this dynamic we're in today, where we're transitioning from money match to full formula, what Senator Whitsitt had me go through has nothing to do with your full formula benefit, or sorry, your money match benefit. Mm-hmm. So when we retired 80 to 90% of the people in their money match, that factor had nothing to do with what your benefit was. Mm-hmm. Now that we're transitioning to a full formula system, it's much more important and has a much greater impact on your final benefit amount than it did when we were predominantly money match. So we'll get you some figures on participation and cost related to those two pieces of the benefit formula.
Okay, I guess we'll talk more about it later. Thanks.
Can I ask one more question? And that is, Mr. Redmond, could you, you probably don't have this on the top of your head, but how much sick leave at 50% and how much vacation time could the average employee getting ready to retire actually accrue?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, you're right, I don't. But let me talk about a couple of limitations. Understand, first off, that, again, we cover public employees. So every employer can have their own policies relating to vacation payout. As a state employee, for example, when I leave service, I'm limited to 240 hours, or maybe it's 250, as far as how many vacation hours I can get paid for when I leave state employment. Is it 250? 240. Thank you, Tamara. Other employers are different. Some may have no limit at all. Some may have a different limit than the number of hours you can get credit for. On sick leave, under the statute, an employee cannot accrue more than 8 hours a month toward that sick leave that's paid under this program. So an employer could give their employees 12 hours of sick leave a month if they wanted to, but they can't accrue more than 8 hours a month for PERS purposes, and the statute also directs that whenever a member takes sick leave, it comes off of that accumulated bucket in PERS first. So whatever that excess is, you have to eat through the PERS before you start eating into that bucket as far as we're concerned in your sick leave balance at the end.
Which all requires extra complicated record keeping on top of everything else. Fabulous. Thank you.
Just to be clear, there'd be essentially 6 weeks of vacation leave that you could accrue.
And in the state?
Yes, for the state. And then whatever...
whatever accumulated sick leave at 8 hours.
50% of whatever you figure you come up with for us on the other is added to it as
correct.
A part of the... So for the sake of argument, say it was 60 hours of sick leave, it'd be 300 hours, and then you would divide that by three... to level it out over 3 years, so it would be equivalent of an extra 100 hours of pay for that 3 years.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, we don't average it out. We put it all in when it's paid.
Yes.
So your 1 year gets inflated in our math, yes. But then you're right. I got to look at your three highest years. So in effect, it does get spread
Thank
out.
You. Thank you very much.
Representative Call.
Chair. Steiner Hayward, the only comment I'd make about your comment about the record keeping, having worked in a school district, they actually have a really good system to figure out how many hours we work and how many we don't. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about the fact that you have to take the sick leave off of the PERS part of the time first, and then, you know what I'm saying? It's just, it.
Well, and I would agree that. Because my situation is different than many people, because anyway, my PERS got messed up, and it doesn't matter, but it's all over and fixed, but it was part of these calculations, mm-hmm. And it was real messy.
Yeah, it is real messy, and that's
yeah,
part of the problem.
That, yeah, thank you.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Steiner Hayward. Do most states allow for this to include the vacation and the sick pay into the final calculation? I mean, it just seems to me that we're running the risk of there being inconsistencies in how people are being paid off. I'm concerned about two employees sitting next to each other for 30 years coming to work every day. One could be a single mom who had to take all of her time to take care of children, mm-hmm. which is often the case, and then perhaps another individual that didn't face like those life circumstances. And then in the end, that could work against that individual, but they did the same work as a public employee. So that's where I'm coming from. And so I'm just trying to understand why, not that I know you didn't come up with this, but why would we set up a system that factors in something that could lead to one person benefiting more than another when they've had the same job? And wondering if other states go about it this way. But I know you're doing a fabulous job, and I know you're not responsible for this. But
well, Co-Chair Steiner and Representative Taylor, these provisions are, I don't know on a census basis mm-hmm. How many other systems use them, but they're not unusual.
Okay.
You'll also note, though, if you look at the comparison across the programs, we don't do this in OPSERP anymore.
Okay.
So when OPSERP was created in 2003, these sort of special incentives were taken away, if
okay.
you want to call them that.
Okay. So it's done now, and we learn from it.
It's done now, yeah, in the sense of the majority of members that come into the system, any new member that comes into the system since 2003, cannot use that sort of dynamic. But you're also right. We are a result of our history, and people retiring today after 30 years, the two people you posited, they're going to have different results because of the different usage of the leave accrual that they had available to them through the course of their career.
Thank you.
It's an issue, as always.
So the next slide is one I want to spend a fair amount of time pointing out a couple of realities, if you will, about the PERS system. The pie chart up in the upper left shows you how many of our benefit recipients receive less than $3,000 a month. And you see it's almost 70%. And the reason that it's so many recipients receiving what would probably be considered a relatively modest amount of monthly benefits, the reason for that varies. There's people that haven't spent a whole career in state service or public service. There's people that retired decades ago when salaries were, or based on salaries that were even older than that before they actually retired, and their benefit has been limited to a cost of living increase every year. So there are a variety of reasons why people would receive less than 3,000. The point is there's so many of them, and they are obviously the biggest hunk of the system and the biggest hunk of people that we service. It's only in contrast to the people that you hear about more regularly in news reports who receive high PERS benefits or relatively high PERS benefits. You can see those are the anomalies. You can see that those are people who, due to a combination of circumstances, have come out at a higher benefit level than normal. But on average, we hover right around $27,000 a year as our average benefit recipient.
Thank you, Chair Steiner Hayward. Mr. Rudman, what would be really helpful is if we had another bar on that graph that showed the average retirement benefit for someone who spent a full career, and you can define a career as 25 years or 30 years or whatever you want to do. But, you know, what brings that to mind, I know a gentleman well who is a mechanic and worked in the private sector, and after he retired, he worked as a school custodian for a while, where he gets about $80 a month from PERS. And so that really tends to bring the, you know, to the extent that he's multiplied across the state, that really brings the average down. So it would be very helpful to know what the average full, you know, the career employee is getting.
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, you're right. This is the full system. We do publish what we call our replacement ratio study, where we look at what is a person's salary at retirement compared to their benefit. And in there, we screen out a lot of those shorter career folks and only look at what is a replacement ratio for somebody that's been 20 or 30 years into the system. So we can pull those numbers together for you.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
The next slide is just, if you'll pardon me, a bit gratuitous, knowing all of you represent different parts of the state. I thought it would be good for you to know that we pay benefits all around the state. We put about $3.2 billion out in benefits every year to all different counties throughout the state. So this is broken down by the number of retirees and their total dollar amount and then their average dollar amount. So a good amount of money is paid out by PERS out to the state and predominantly in the state, I think I would note. $3.2 billion goes to recipients who reside in Oregon. Only about $500 million goes to people who reside outside of the state. So we keep a lot of the money that we pay in the state where, again, it has an economic multiplier effect. A lot of questions about the relative mix of Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3. I threw this chart in here just to show you how Tier 1-centric this system still is. The blue bar that you see are the benefit payments projected out to Tier 1 members over the next 30 years. And Tier 1 members continue to receive the majority of benefit payments until 2042. So, Representative Taylor, when you're asking about sick leave and all that, and I tell you that OPSERP members don't get that benefit. The people that did get that benefit are still hanging in this system and continue to cost this system going forward for quite a long time. We are the super tanker of public policy. It takes a very long time to change direction. in where and how.
I'm quoting that one, right, left, and backwards, Mr. Hogan.
You see, though, the orange band shows you the transition to Tier 2, and then the green band is OPSERP. And whereas it starts out as a sliver, it takes over longer into the future that we go. But just keep in mind when we get questions about when will Tier 1 be out of the system and when will the provisions of Tier 2 not affect the cost of PERS, very long tail in that.
And is that exacerbated by the fact that when we set the system up 30, 40 years ago, people's lifespans were shorter too, right? I mean, the actuarial tables must be changing on a fairly regular, right now they're probably relatively stable because unfortunately we have people who are not making great choices in their health, but that must have been a problem. And when life expectancy keeps increasing, that doesn't make your life any easier.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, it is a challenge. We are directed under statute, again, this is part of the O3 reforms, to update our mortality assumptions at least every 2 years. So we do correct every 2 years when we go through our experience study.
When you're sending us stuff, would you just be kind enough to send us what your mortality study, the numbers that you guys have come up with? Is that hard to do over the past
It's not a nuisance. It's a matter of translation.
Okay.
Because we don't know when someone's going to retire, our mortality tables, actually our actuarial factor tables, cover a range of ages and a range of balances. So they're available.
Well, then don't worry about it. I'm just thinking about, you know, life expectancy, and I guess it's sort of equivalent, so don't worry about it. It's never mind.
Okay. Fine. It is in our experience study as well, so we do report on that, like I say, every 2 years. I think, though, what you're seeing in this graph is not so much the extension of life expectancy as it is the fact that Tier 1 members were in this system up until 1996, and that's a relatively short time ago in a retirement system. So I have a large group of Tier 1 members that are in retirement and also going to be getting into retirement, as you'll see on the next slide. So it is the cost of that group. The other point, of course, is that Tier 1, particularly in the 90s and 2000s, retired with a much higher share of their final average salary. So the cost of their benefits are higher, and that's going to carry forward for as long as they live. That's how this retirement system works. So on the next slide, we talk about who's eligible to retire. And here the point is that our aging population in the workforce is revealed through these statistics as well. When you look down at the bottom right, 32% of the people in public service are eligible to retire either by age or service, according to our statistics. So that's a large group of people that could conceivably walk out of the workforce in overnight. There's a lot of factors, obviously, that are leaving them at work. There's a difference between the ability to retire and the affordability of retirement. So this gives you, though, a breakdown of where and how those members are scattered across our what we call actuarial groups, which is down the left side, state, school districts, local government, judges, and community college, and then across our different programs of Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP. So you also see in the right-hand column the percentage of members eligible to retire varies quite a bit among those actuarial groups. So that's an overview of the system and its dynamics. I wanted to talk a little bit about how the system is balanced or financed. So this is the formula that I like to trot out to do this because most of us hopefully can remember at least our basic algebra. And we can understand the concept that one side of an equation has to be equal to the other side of the equation. So benefits have to equal contributions plus earnings in this system. If that formula does not balance, we are broke. So The benefits is what we determine when we do a system valuation. A valuation is an actuarial exercise we do at the end of every calendar year. So we have the 12/31/13 valuation that was completed. We are in the process of working on the 12/31/14 valuation. And what that valuation does is it takes a look at our population, our census data, and looks at all of the people that are members of PERS from different stages in their career and different salaries, looks at what benefits they're being paid today if they're retired, or benefits they have accrued up to that date if they have yet to retire, and reduces all of that stream of payments down to a present value as of 12/31. So when I talk about benefits equals contributions plus earnings, it's that present value of earned benefits that is expressed in this formula. Benefits are set by the Oregon legislature. The plan is written by you. So you have an effect on the B in this formula, a direct effect on the B. And we'll talk about what you've done historically to affect that benefit side of the equation. The benefits have to be equaled by contributions plus earnings. The contributions are employer and member contributions that come into the system to fund the benefits. And those contributions are set by the PERS board as far as the employer contributions go. Members contribute 6%, and that 6% has been in statute for quite a long time. Employers fund different, contribute at different rates set by the PERS board every 2 years. So the PERS board uses contributions to balance this formula. And that is the aspect of this formula that is under their control. So when the valuation comes back and the actuary says, this is the benefits that people have accrued, he also tells us how do employer contributions have to change to pay for those benefits that have already been accrued. Then the last component of this is earnings. And the earnings are managed by the Oregon Investment Council, who works with the state treasury staff. The Oregon Investment Council sets an asset allocation for the dollars that are in the PERS fund. So members and employers contribute into the PERS fund. That money is then turned over to the OIC to invest. The OIC invests it into different categories of assets, real estate, stocks, bonds, etc., in what they determine to be the proper allocation of those assets to yield the most productive rate of return that they can prudently derive using the investment of the funds that they have. And there's a lot of balancing to that. Some aspects of investments obviously are projected to return greater amounts, but there's risk involved in that. So how much risk taking is prudent given the nature of this fund and what it's being used for? That's the balance that the OIC has to strike. So those earnings come spinning off of the fund to balance this equation. The contributions vary in response to what those earnings are expected to get over the course of the future of the fund. And overall, then, the PERS board has to adjust that C to bring all those into balance.
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you. I have several questions, actually. On the 6% pickup, could you give us some information on the percent of employees statewide, just, you know, state districts and so forth, that where the employer is actually paying that 6% contribution?
Co-chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, the member, as I say, statutorily, the member contributes 6%. It used to go into your regular and variable. Now it goes into your individual account program. By arrangement or policy, as Senator Whitsitt alludes to, the employer can agree to pay that 6% on behalf of the member. And the percentages are quite high. And because the populations vary, they're a little different. About 70% of employers pay that pickup, but that represents about 80% of the members because it's predominantly the larger employers that do that. So that means that the employer is paying that 6% on behalf of the member as opposed to taking it off of their salary and making the contribution on their behalf. Both of those occur on a pre-tax basis, So the 6% is taken out of salary or paid on behalf of the member before taxes.
Thank you.
That's a follow-up.
Certainly.
The earnings in that formula are calculated on not actual earnings, but on projected earnings. So could you explain to us in a little more detail how that estimated earnings affects the contributions part?
Co-chair, Senator Hayward, Senator Whitsitt. You're correct in that this formula is balanced based on assumptions into the future. And one of the assumptions is, how much will my current investments earn over that period of time? If the investment return is, the projection of that return is lowered, so that I don't expect to earn as much in investments going into the future, contributions have to go up because the formula must balance. So the contributions are playing off against the earnings. And you'll see a little later, I'll talk about the relative difference between how that's funded, comparing the normal cost of benefits to what's called the unfunded liability portion of the benefits. I've got a little more detail in some slides later. I'll talk about the numbers of that, but the theory of it is, as I've explained, if earnings are projected to go down, contributions must go up.
And could you give us just one more on the, for each percent that earnings go down, roughly how much do, what percentage do contributions have to go up to make up the difference, since earnings make up about 70-75% of the cash flow?
Co-Chair Senator Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, there's the rough approximation is about a 1% drop in returns would be about $1 billion into the unfunded liability. And then that gets amortized out over 20 years. And I don't really have I don't have a ratio like that to tell you. It's about a 1%. Like I say, about a 1% move equals about $1 billion in UAL. A 1% move in employer rates is going to be applied against a large payroll because we cover so many public employees. So a 1% rise in employer rates like that is going to equal a large slice of money. Again, I've got some more statistics on that I can get to, but that's about as close as I can come to a ratio.
Thank you. Anything else, Senator?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you
right now. Good.
So, Senator Whitsitt has actually previewed many of the points on this. Thank you, sir. one of the particular points I wanted to make is in that pie chart in the upper left. As you said, Senator, investment income accounts for about, you said 70 to 75. It's 73% as of this moment of the funding of the system. So when I look at how much is in the PERS fund, 73% of the money in the PERS fund has come through investment earnings over time. Employer contributions have been about 21% of the amount that's in the fund, and member contributions are about 6% of the money that's in the fund. Now, that member contribution slice keeps shrinking because the 6% is going into the individual account program. So it's no longer being used to fund the defined benefit portion. So that 6% is going to shrink over time because contributions are shrinking or have no longer been going into the fund. So the point to emphasize here is I think the point that Senator Whitsitt was making, that we are very dependent on investment income and on good investment income. When investment income does not come in at expectation, then that puts pressure on the PERS board to change contribution rates and pressure on this legislative body to adjust benefits like you did in 2013. The right-hand pie chart is another one to point out in relation to that benefit adjustment. When, as the conversation that we had in 2013 related to cost reduction was a result of the investment losses in 2008. So in 2008, in the financial downturn, we lost a significant amount of the PERS fund. Contributions had to be raised to make up for that loss. The pressure on employer rates rose to a point where the legislature decided to reduce the cost of benefits to members going forward. And that is an effect on the B in our formula. If you drop the B, then contributions don't have to rise as much to pay for the B. The point in this right-hand chart that I want to emphasize is how much of our present liability is to retired members and inactives. If you look at that left slice of the pie, 60% of our current liability is to people who have already retired from the system. And another 8% is to people who are inactive. Those are people who have vested benefits in PERS but no longer work for a PERS-covered employer. The solution, then, in reducing the benefits that was arrived at in 2013 was to reduce the cost of living adjustment. Because the cost of living adjustment, which is how we're going to increase your benefits after you retire every year, was a solution that affected the entire pie. Everybody in that pie is getting or was going to get a cost of living adjustment. If you want to reduce benefits, that cost of living adjustment was the thing that affected everybody in that pie. If instead, for example, you wanted to just reduce benefits for new entrants into the retirement system, then you're not affecting anybody in that pie. Or if you just reduce the benefits of people still working in PERS, you're only affecting a solution on 32% of the people 32% of the liability of the people in the system. So it's important, again, back to the point I made earlier on the overall maturity of the system. Being a mature system means we have a large amount of our liability associated with people who have already left the system. And solutions like you reached in 2013 that affect the benefit level has to touch into that retired population to have an effect on the entire population, or you're loading the solution in on only a small slice of the people who are still in the system. Now, as we'll talk about, whether the Supreme Court believes that was something that you could do is still at issue. But that was the strategy that was surrounding the creation of that solution in 2013. The other element I'd like to point out at the bottom real briefly is about funded status and unfunded actuarial liability. So our funded status is the percentage of our assets to our liabilities. When we do evaluation, how close are we to being fully funded? And a distinction here is made between our funded status, including side accounts and excluding side accounts. Knowing I've got some newer members on the panel, let me talk about what side accounts are. An individual employer can decide to make an advance payment to us of their contributions. That's what we call a lump sum side account. So an individual employer can decide that I have a relatively large amount of money that I want to pre-deposit with PERS. What we do is we take in that side account, we credit earnings to it or losses as our investment experience relates, and then we apply a portion of that side account to their contributions. So an employer may get a contribution rate of 20%, but if they have a side account, then their actual contribution rate to us may be more like 15 or 12, because we're taking money from that side account to reduce the contribution rate. Now, most often, those side accounts are funded by what are called pension obligation bonds, or POBs. That's an employer deciding that I'm going to go out and use my bonding authority to get that large amount of money that I'm going to then send to PERS, and I'm going to then have the pension obligation bond proceeds offset my contributions in the future. Excuse me. Bless you. The play there, if you want to call it a play, is that the employer is relying on the fact that that large dollar amount that is deposited with PERS will earn more with PERS than the cost of the bond that the employer is then going to have to retire. So when I talked about the employer saying it has a rate of 20%, but because of their side account, their rate is, let's say, 12%, they also have bond costs if they issued a pension obligation bond that will eat into that 8% reduction. And their calculation is that bond cost will be less than that 8% I would have to be paying PERS for the costs associated with those contributions. So that's a quick primer on what side accounts are. It's an individual employer decision that they make as to whether they have a side account. But you see the difference funded status relative to including or excluding side accounts. Without side accounts, in other words, without taking into account those extra advance deposits, the fund is 86% funded. If you add in the side accounts, it's 96% funded. And as I say, those side accounts are prepaid contributions. They are our money. The employer cannot have it back. So I like to think of the system being 96% funded because that's how much money I have. But when I'm when the actuary is calculating employer rates, that side account is taken out of the picture so that we can see how much they need to make in contributions over time to bring the system to full funding, and then that's where the 86% is used.
Senator Woodson.
Thank you. I know that all side accounts are not equal because, you know, there's basic, as I understand it, based on a positive arbitrage, and sometimes that doesn't work. But what I want to talk about particularly is how the pension obligation bonds in Oregon for the state were structured. Because it appears that in order to keep down the employer contribution rates, they were structured in a way that has paid primarily interest and not too much principal. And I think at this point, this is off the top of my head, but after, since they were sold in 2003?
Yes.
So 12 years into it, we still owe about 80% of the principal. And so, for a better term, our positive arbitrage is about to flip over. It's going to start costing us money. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, I don't think that's true. I don't think it's going to flip in the terms that you're talking about. I don't know about relative principal and interest. What I look at is, are you paying, am I getting more contributions off of that bond than I would have if I had charged you the employer contribution? Mm-hmm. So my point is that the state is still paying a lower net employer rate, mm-hmm. because they're getting a larger offset from that than they would have if they hadn't done it.
No, I didn't phrase my question right, because I know that's how it's working for PERS.
Yeah.
How is it working for the taxpayer?
In that respect, again, I don't know how even a normal bond structures interest versus principal payment. If it's anything like a mortgage, as you well know, much of your early payments go to interest as you reduce the principal balance. So maybe that's going to narrow over time.
I would invite you to look at that and compare it to any home mortgage. It's going the wrong direction. But
okay. So, Senator Whitsitt, picking up in your early conversation about rates, on this slide, what I would like you to focus on is that middle bar, which is the 2015-17 biennia. These are the employer rates that have already been set to come into effect July 1, 2015. We took the valuation as of 12/31/13. Our actuary used that to calculate employer rates that would go into effect July 1, 2015. And we, the PERS Board, adopted those rates last September. We adopt rates so far in advance, of course, to allow people to set their budgets accordingly. So there's always going to be this lag between when the valuation occurs and when the rates are set. But just looking at that 2015-17 biennia, Senator Whitsitt, you were asking about the different rates of return. In that biennia, and just looking at the base rates, which is a lighter bar, the base rates are what the pure employer rate is, and that's 17.5%. So that's a percentage of the payroll that is paid to PERS members by these employers. And that's a system-wide average. And please note, nobody pays average. Everybody's somewhere around that average. But in any case, that's the system-wide average. That 17.5 rate has two components. One is what's called the normal cost, and the other is what's called the UAL rate, or the unfunded actuarial liability rate. We are in a deficit. In the prior slide you saw, we're 86% funded without side accounts. So that deficit has to be recovered through contributions. And the contributions expect that deficit to be amortized over 20 years. So we expect that 14% of system funding to come in through what are called unfunded actuarial liability rate over 20 years. That rate in this 17.5 is 7.24% of payroll. So of that 17.5% base rate, 7.25% of that is just to pay the unfunded liability. And that's where I was saying, if you look at the accrued liability, 68% of that being retired and inactives, 7.25% of this rate is to pay for the cost of those liabilities for people who are already out the door. So the unfunded actuarial liability is funded at 7.25%. That 7.25% is based on an assumed rate of 7.75. If we used a private annuity analogy like you were suggesting, Senator, where maybe we use more of a 4.25% rate, for example, that UAL, instead of being 7.25% of that rate, would be 25%. So employer rates would be more than 3 times higher if we used that lower rate of return, just to pay for the unfunded liability. That is how dependent we are on positive earnings and a relatively high rate of earnings compared to what a private investor might get with their retirement funds. The base rates then that you see there, sorry, so that's the base rates, the latter column. The net rates have to show the effect of the side account offsets. And that's, again, individual to employers, because individual employers have different side accounts in relative terms to their obligations to PERS. And that's then the system level effect to bring the net rate down to 10.6 from 17.5. So again, about 7% of our contributions will come from side accounts in the next biennium rather than from employers. So 15-17 rates, we show you what those are projected out to be and compare them to prior biennia. State and local government rate pool, the state as an employer and the university system and other local governments who have chosen to come in all operate as a pool. In other words, their experience is combined across all the employers so that that is what you use to set their employer rate. It's a spreading of the risk across a larger population. So changes in those demographics don't have as great of an effect on a small employer or an individual employer. If, say, you were a city that only had 5 employees and one of your employees, for example, went out on disability at a young age, your unfunded liability for that benefit could be quite high. And if you're not in a pool, then you have to pay for that unfunded liability instead of spreading it across the pools. So state and local government is one rate pool. School districts are all pooled among themselves in setting employer rates. And then independent employers are employers that are just on their own, not in a rate pool. So shows you the relative changes in employer rates expected for 15-17. State and local government rate pool is looking to go up while the school districts go down, and independents are going to go up just a little bit.
So can I just comment on that really briefly? One of the things that I think those of us who've been doing Ways and Means for a long time get, and I think Representative Hurd and Representative Taylor can figure out, is that that percentage that we have to, that part that we have to give in for employer rates, when we put a budget into K-12, a certain percentage of that for every school district goes into just paying into the PERS system, right? So when we look at our number, so the work that PERS is doing, the work that the Oregon Investment Council is doing, the work that the legislature has done to control the benefit side, to be part of that equation, has a direct impact on school budgets. And not just because of long-term stuff, but because of what we're paying out right this minute. And because that's nothing that, none of that money goes directly to kids today, right? So there is no two ways around it, and I'm not saying that our teachers don't deserve great retirement packages for the work that they do. I'm just explaining that one of the reasons that all of these things that Mr. Rodman is telling us about are so important is because they directly affect how many teachers we put in classrooms and how many days our kids are in school. And that's why the work that we did in 2013 was so important, painful but important. So,
Senator Woodsit,
and then
Representative Carl. Thank you. Mr. Edmund, the table there does not include the 6% pickup that most employers pay?
Correct. You're right. And it doesn't include that. It also doesn't include the health insurance portion of the of their rates, which is, you know, 1.5%.
Then add another 7.5% to that on 80% of them anyway. And then the other question is on the pension obligation bond. It's my understanding that might be remembrance that part of that obligation is paid by PERS and part of it is paid by general fund. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Woodsit, I don't know how it's paid by PERS. I'm not sure what you mean by that.
So then the entire debt service is paid by the general fund then?
Well, the entire debt service is paid by the employer's source of funds. Could be general fund, could be federal funds, could be other taxes, fees. Depends on how the employer gets their money.
Yes. I'll have to formulate it. Thank you. Okay. I'll have to formulate that question better.
Right. So, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, you actually transitioned me well to the future.
Try to help, Mr. Evans.
All the help that, or all the work that you did in 2013 to reduce the B in that formula to bring contributions back down to those levels. Our actuary runs a stochastic model every couple of years to show what the future might look like under a variety of investment scenarios. And I just wanted to alert you to some probabilities of what that projection looks like. These are just some of the events and the likelihood of them occurring over the next 20 years. Our funded status, excluding static accounts exceeding 100%, that shows up in 75% of those scenarios. So in 3 out of 4 aspects of the future, we can expect at some point to have funded status in excess of 100%. 44% of the time, we can expect to have funded status less than 60%. There is a great amount of variability within the funded status and health of this system and that relative formula balance from biennia to biennia, and that is driven only by investment returns. When we have a good year, things stay relatively flat. When we have a great year, employer rates go down. When we have a bad year, we're chasing money through the contribution change. And as you said, Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, that means that that's going to have much more pressure on the budgets. More than the funded status for the base rate. I'm sorry.
If you could just give us a little a primer on the effects of the low interest rate on the risk factors of PERS investment. Traditionally, retirement funds, private and public, have been put into more fixed return vehicles. And in order to get to an 8% return when you have a 1.5% average interest return, you have to invest in things like REITs and other things that are not really too stable. So could you kind of explain that a little bit?
Sure. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Woodsit, the lore is you'd look for a 60-40 portfolio, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, and that would be pretty stable over time and would yield a good return that would fund your retirement system. As you say, that's probably back in the world where stocks returned 9 and bonds returned 7, and you could be around that 8% roughly. Bonds don't do that anymore. Haven't for since the financial downturn. So consequently, your fixed income stable investments are going to earn relatively less than they have historically. And consequently, you either have to change your allocation to put more weight into those higher earning assets to maintain a higher rate of return, or you do as we have done and start reducing your assumed rate in recognition of the fact that this lower rate environment has been and will persist for time into the future. So we lowered it in 2013. There is downward pressure on that again. And March 4th at the Oregon Investment Council meeting, their consultants returned a recommended rate at 7.5. And while we still have a lot of work to do with our actuaries to get to what the right rate is for PERS, that was the OIC's investment projection over 10 years. And a lot of it is driven by what you said, the lower rate return expected over a period of time in those other alternative investments.
It's back on the back slide. Yeah, that's right. Thank you, Chair Hayward, Steiner Hayward. The question I have, because we've had quite a overflow in our email boxes about the current proposal for the education budget not being enough, and so I'm looking at that line where it says that the, if I understand what I'm hearing, that in 13-15 our employers contributed 13.2% to PERS, and then in 15-17 it's going to drop a full 2%.
I'm not sure what number you're, what slide you're on. Is it this one?
That slide.
Oh.
With the
school districts.
Yeah.
Got it. Yes. You're right. So on average, school districts contributed 13.2 in 13-15, and it's going to go down to 10.57 in 15-17.
And so one of our analysts could calculate out of the 7.2, whatever we're going to, whatever that final number is, how much we're really going to save with doing what, like you say, it was hard to do to do the PERS bill that we did, but this is why, and how much it's going to save and put money into the classroom.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big number. I'd have to do a lot of math with a lot of zeros, but it is a big number, and bear in mind that that number is an average across all the schools,
right,
as you well know, Chair, since you chair the education subcommittee, but I'm just making clear to everybody else. But yeah, I mean, a 2%, 2.5% decrease is significant when you're talking about a budget of $7.2 billion with a B. And those numbers translated, those savings translate into teachers in the classroom, school days in the school year.
Tremendously.
And it's very real. Thank you, Representative Comp, for pointing that out.
Anything that says school, I kind of start.
I'm sure you do. And
my wheels turn.
Obviously, that plays into the work that you and Senator Monroe are doing.
Thank you.
So, thank you. Anything else before we move on, folks? Okay. Thank you.
So just real quickly, this is, like I say, a preview into the future. Varying return scenarios. The next slide to me is even more concerning. And this is, what is the probability just within the next three biennia that we're going to look at a rate increase of 3, 4, or 5% of pay? You can see that the probabilities are pretty high. So it's, again, just a reflection of the variability of the investment returns that we have and the maturity of the system, where a change in the investment returns, because we have a relatively small base of active members to apply that change across, yields quite a change in the pay rate that we expect as contributions. The system average rates, this is, again, a projection with our actuary Milliman. You can just pick whatever line you think looks like what you think the investment environment is going to look like in the future. But if we could manage to return 10.5 as a rate of return, my system is fully funded, and I don't charge you any contributions after 2027. A guy can hope. the blue line is the mid-range. That's a 7.75 steady return. And there, even notice how on the blue line the slope goes down, because we're replacing Tier 1 and Tier 2 members with OPSERP members, lower benefit, lower cost. So even if we make our earnings assumption at 7.75, the slope goes down. The orange line is, even if we assume 7.75 but we just make 7, the slope stays about the same. And then the red line is the danger. That's if we only make a 5% rate of return. Now, this is a single line level rate of return scenario, or number of scenarios. The next couple slides I put in just, again, to underscore the point of variability. I'm not going to explain what all the different numbers here mean, but this is the result of that stochastic modeling. So these are average contribution rates. And again, you can pick wherever you think the future looks. The 50% or 50th percentile is the mid-range. That's, again, if we have our assumed earnings rate. But if we have a good year or a good stretch of years, that's into the green area. If we have bad stretches of years, that's in the blue area. Please just note how tall the candlesticks are. That's the point on this slide, is how variable the range is within which we're going to set contribution rates going forward depending on the circumstances. And again, this is the side accounts, the funded status excluding side accounts. Again, note the range. So if you think in the future your presentation to PERS will be consistent and along a path of predictability, it's not. It's going to be somewhere in these candlesticks. And again, you can pick which one side of it, the green or the blue, you think is more likely. But that's the reality of the system, is that we bounce around a lot and put a lot of pressure, consequently, on employers, because that's the only source of funding we have that varies in this system. So this shows again that variability. This is the PERS funded fund value at the calendar end, just to show you how it moves. It's not in a straight line. It's not predictable. As it dipped down in the early 2000s, that led up to PERS reform in 2003. As it dipped down in 2008, that led to PERS reform in 2013. Let's hope these bars keep climbing. If not, we'll be back talking about another round of what can we do about the B.
I want to point out one other thing that I think most people in this committee get, but for anybody who's watching at home or watches this later, one could look at that and say, well, gee, we were at $65 billion in 2007, and now we're back up to $70 billion. Why are we so worried about this? And the answer is because if we'd been at $65 billion in 2007 and it stayed there and then we kept going up, we would now be somewhere closer to about 85, right, somewhere in that light fixture, exactly. Yeah. we'd be somewhere, you would have had to change your scale.
Yes.
To get us well above 80 or 85,000 million, billion, 85 billion, those, all those zeros, dollars. And the point is we can never make back what we lost. Even the changes that we do help, but we can't get back what was lost. And I don't think there's anything to suggest that the Investment Council did anything wrong except be misled the way many other people were misled by what a lot of the banks were doing. So that's why it's such an issue for us, because you just can't make it back.
I was just going to say, if you just referred back to slide 13, you picked that bar, which was our peak of 2007, when we were 98% funded with outside accounts.
Right.
And you're right. If that had just gone forward at 8% a year for the intervening years, last year wouldn't have happened, or last session wouldn't have happened.
No. Senator Johnson.
These graphs are very helpful, and I appreciate your presenting them. Have you projected or contemplated what other external events, for example, the court ruling against the state, how that fits in to this scenario?
We have Senator Johnson, and that's coming up on slide 25. So I'll get to that in just a minute, if I may. So the next slide, just a note, this is one of the reports that the LFO staff put together this fall, having to do with what the PERS board has done in some of its actuarial methods and assumptions. And I already talked about some of this. We reduced the assumed rate from 8 to 7.75. We changed the actuarial cost allocation method to entry age normal. That's a little inside baseball, and I apologize for the terminology. But basically, our actuary has to use a method to assign cost to the benefits that accrue from year to year. Like I say, the valuation is a point in time, 12/31/2013. But the next day, someone's going to go to work and earn additional benefits. So those additional benefits are costed using a couple of different methods. And we use now the entry age normal method, which means for another year of service, this is what your year of service is going to cost us, and that's your normal cost rate. So we changed from a projected unit credit method to the interage normal method. That was driven by national standards relating to the Government Accounting Standards Board that I wasn't going to go into, but that's why that change was made. We re-amortized those Tier 1, Tier 2 liabilities over 20 years, and then we modified the rate collar. And again, in 2015, we'll take a look at the assumed rate. And so far, the Callan report has at least given us a directional note that that will the pressure will be to reduce that.
Re-amortized accumulated Tier 1 and Tier 2 liabilities over 20 years. That sounds almost like refinancing. Did you actually spread out the liability for a longer period of time and thereby reduce the short-term liability? What did you do there?
Co-Chair Standing Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, what we did was took the UAL, which was some $8 billion, and we could have sent every employer a check, or sorry, an invoice, to pay your share of $8 billion. Mm-hmm. But instead, we spread that $8 billion out over 20 years on a level percent of payroll and set a rate for that. And that's that UAL rate that I talked about 7.25 that was in 15-17 rates.
That's what I was afraid you said. Yes. Thank you.
20 years is actually, just in comparison, 20 years is actually relatively conservative. Many systems go out 30 or 40 years. So at least we only spread it over 20. What's been done to the B? This is the actions that the legislature has taken about the benefit side of the equation. Some reform, like I mentioned in 2003, where we created OPSERP and diverted the 6% contribution, limited crediting to Tier 1 accounts to the assumed rate. In 2005, the Supreme Court upheld most of that legislation. In 2011, a small step was taken in the tax remedy area to eliminate that tax remedy benefit for people that retired after January 1 of 2012. But in 2013, that tax remedy payment was eliminated for all out-of-state residents, as well as significant reductions in the cost of living adjustment. So what that did, the results of that, was to, in 2003, that reduced the growth of accounts in Tier 1, so that we reduced the benefits that were paid to Tier 1 members. And you can see the trend of that over time as the diversion of the account contributions into the individual account reduced the growth of money match, and therefore the replacement ratio, which was hovering around 100% for 30-year retirees, sloped down towards 2013, and then for all retirees, the same drop in the slope. So that is nothing less than a reduction in the benefit that those retirees would have gotten otherwise from the 2003 PERS reforms. And then the 2013 reforms, Senate Bills 822 and 861, were challenged in the Oregon Supreme Court. Senator Johnson, back to your question. This is, again, was the subject of an LFO report earlier in the fall. If the Supreme Court overturned those provisions, we'd be looking at about a $6 billion increase in unfunded liabilities by the time those liabilities came into the valuation process, and about a 5.5% of payroll increase. Probably not until July 1, 2017, but kind of depends on when that opinion comes and what the severity of it is. So did that answer your question, Senator Johnson?
Yes, it did.
Okay. So where does that leave us?
Excuse me, Senator Whitsitt.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Rubin. And when the investment debacles occurred in 2008, the collaring system actually caused the reduction in employer contributions for the next 2 years, which exacerbated the problem even further. And then there was this huge increase, 2 years later. Wouldn't that same, won't this have the same effect if the Supreme Court does not uphold these changes and we incur another $5 billion of unfunded liabilities and then we don't do anything about it for 2 years? Won't we just recreate the same problem we had before?
Co-Chair Steiner here with Senator Whitsitt. You're right. The longer you take to start paying the cost of the system, the more the costs go up. So these are just projections of what the effect of the Supreme Court reversal would have on the unfunded liability and payroll. Then overlaying that comes the rate collar system, which this looks at a 5.5% of payroll increase. Generally, the rate collar system limits increase in employer rates to 3% of payroll per biennium, depending on your funded status, and it is a sliding scale, and different employers would be affected differently. That's why I put in the last line of the slide that those increases would probably not come until July 1, 2017, because the PERS board sets employer rates, and the PERS board could change rates sooner to start paying that back sooner, consequence being that they would make those rate changes in the midst of a budget cycle, so affected employers would be charged more during that cycle. Mm-hmm. And it also depends on the other circumstances. By other circumstances, I mean how is the system otherwise looking? We had, as I think you know, we returned less than the assumed rate in 2014. 2015 depends on what day it is, whether you're looking pretty good or pretty bad. It's been awfully volatile.
Yeah.
So in the midst of as my predecessor, Mr. Cleary, liked to say, when you're at the bottom of the canyon, you can't see your way out. If we're at the bottom of the canyon when the Supreme Court issues its decision, we may start climbing out faster than if we were midway up the slope by the time that came in. It's all going to have to deal with when is the PERS board think is the prudent time to act, and what is the acceptance from our employer community of a change in rates resulting from that? Or we could win the Supreme Court decision, and this would be moot. Mm-hmm.
That would be nice.
So just my last slide today was where does this leave the system, and this is a prelude to the conversation for tomorrow. As you can see, the numbers of transactions keep climbing, we are very busy in trying to support our members in the decisions they're making as they try to get ready for retirement. So we'll talk tomorrow about what strategies have we developed in our planning to address those needs of our members and how we're trying to get ahead of these numbers with the service that we can provide. So with that, I'll close unless there's other questions.
Thank you very much. Other questions?